Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chats, a fortnightly podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will. And this week we've got with us Aaron Bassett, developer advocate for Mongo and all-round good guy, member of DSF board and all-round good guy. Hello, Aaron.
Hey, Carlton.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to the show. Let's kick off. Tell us about yourself and how you got into Django and how we know you and all those things so that we've got your backstory.
Oh, gosh. So as you mentioned, I'm a developer advocate for MongoDB, which I know is not probably the first thing people think of when they think of Django, MongoDB, but I've been a kind of member of the Django community for, well, since before Django hit version one, to be honest. Before I got into developer advocacy, I was a software engineer, worked for a couple of different software agencies, and one of them I was lucky enough to be able to convert from a homegrown PHP CMS into using Django. So that's kind of where my love affair started. And I've been a heavy user of Django ever since. Talked several times at DjangoCon Europe and DjangoCon US. And as you mentioned, I've now been a member of the DSF board for almost a year now. Elections are coming up soon.
I remember the first time I saw you was at DjangoCon Europe in Florence, where you gave a great talk on the testing pyramid.
I'm glad you said that was a great talk because I was incredibly ill that day. So I'm glad that didn't come across. That was actually the conference as well where I decided to become a developer advocate. I was still working in software engineering at the time for a company based out of Edinburgh and had come to Florence to give the talk. Had been asked to help Mark Smith out at the Nexmo booth. They were a bit short-staffed, and then kind of realized, like, oh, so you give talks and go to conferences for a living? Like, you don't pay to be here, you get paid to be here? And that's when I decided to make the move myself.
That was what prompted it, like the lifestyle or the because it's an issue, lots of people in the agency environment, and it's quite high pressure, and you've got these constant deadlines, and, you know, they're... I don't know about the agencies you worked in, but that was the agencies I worked in.
Yeah.
What was the appeal of being a developer advocate?
To be honest, I'd kind of been doing it for many years before I officially started. Whenever I used to live in Glasgow many years ago, there wasn't a huge tech community there. You know, there was a tech community in Edinburgh, and that was really seen as being the heart of kind of software engineering and development in Scotland. But Glasgow really didn't have that same sense of community. There was a lot of developers in Glasgow, most of them working in finance, but there wasn't really any kind of meetups and there wasn't any kind of social events or anything like that. And a group of us got together and decided to fix that. We were very community-minded, wanted to have an excuse to go out and have a couple of beers with similar-minded folks. So we started a meetup called WebCentric. The founders of that went on to found things like Tech Meetup in Glasgow and BarCamp and CodeCraft and a bunch of other different ones. But it was really that trying to look for a sense of community which got me into it in the first place. And although I was still just working as a regular kind of engineer in like an agency at the time, we started to like give talks at the meetups. And as anybody who's organized kind of regular meetups with speakers will tell you, it can be quite difficult to get speakers lined up every month. So it got to the situation where I was speaking at a fairly regular cadence at these different meetups. Anytime we didn't have somebody to fill us the slot, then it was like, okay, well, what's the topic of this month's meetup? HTML5. Okay, right, Aaron can talk about that. That's fine. Let's just put him in there. But it wasn't until 2014, I think, DjangoCon Europe, the time in Poland when they held it in the big circus tent, that I got up and gave like a lightning talk. Yeah, it was a great conference. Like, I'm actually probably my first ever DjangoCon, and also my first time on stage. I didn't give a full conference talk, but I gave a lightning talk, which if anybody's listening is interested in getting into conference speaking, that's a great way to like test the water. You know, not a lot of preparation required. You know, 5 minute slot. Everybody is so supportive. You know, it's just a nice, fun time. You get up there. It's daunting. Like, I was surprised anybody could hear what I was saying because my legs were shaking that much. I was sure that all you could hear was them tapping on the stage. Like, I thought I was going to drown out everything I said. But I came off the stage afterwards and was like, Yeah, that was fun. It was terrifying, but fun.
I should have taken that advice. My first talk was like a 40-minute one at DjangoCon. Well, that's not true. I did it at Django Boston before that. So to your point about getting guests every month, I'm not one of the organizers, but I've worked with them. And there was a while I was speaking a bunch. And even in Boston, which has a lot of developers, it's so much work to be an organizer of these things. But it brings so much to the community because otherwise we're all, you know, in our offices on our computers.
Yeah, we ended up switching it for, I was helping organize PIFE in Glasgow for a while. And we actually ended up switching it. So instead of having, like, trying to do monthly speakers, it was then they would have a cadence of doing, okay, well, one month we'll have talks, and the next month we'll do a dojo, and then the next month we'll just have a social meet, you know, just go to a local bar, and next month talks, dojo, bars. And it's a lot easier to find speakers kind of once every quarter, essentially, rather than every month.
Yeah, and you can ask them when you're meeting with them socially, sort of pull out topics that they may not have thought of, as opposed to, you know, an email blast to the community saying who wants to speak.
And it means then you've got a bit more time to organize it as well. So if you've got somebody who, you know, you maybe not be in the local community, but, you know, you really want to hear from, then, you know, it gives you more time to organize and maybe like get their travel sorted and get them free to the city and things like that as well.
I had a couple more questions on the sort of dev rel life before. Mm-hmm. We moved on. One was like 3 years later, how are you still liking it? Because you're traveling all the time and all the rest. And then the second part of that is, how's 2020 been with COVID and all remote and the massive change there?
Yeah, so travel's obviously, it's completely gone away now. I went from, I think at the peak I was doing, oh gosh, I can't remember what the distance was now, but it was like equivalent to 4.5 times around the world, like per year.
Well,
so I've spent 56% of my working time on the road.
Okay, Raza.
So yeah, a lot of travel.
That sounds like heaven for some people and hell for a lot of others.
Well, to be honest, I was really enjoying it. I had no commitments at home or anything like that. So it was really the time to kind of do that part of my life. And I at that stage, I was kind of, well, I was on the road so often that it didn't even make sense to have a lease for a mortgage anywhere. You know, I was literally away from home more than I would have been there. So I ended up just the time I wasn't traveling for a conference, just spending it in like Airbnbs or visiting different cities and stuff. And it was great. I don't think it's for everybody. You know, it's a very difficult kind of lifestyle to maintain for a while, living out of a 35 liter backpack. But for that time of my life, like it, you know, I wouldn't trade it for anything. You know, I really enjoyed it. I got to meet some amazing people. I got to give a lot of conference talks, you know, and I got paid to do it. It was great. Whenever I moved from my previous position, now to have MongoDB, the amount of travel was due to be less, and now it's none. You know, it's with COVID, well, I'm in Miami now, and that looks like where I'm going to be staying for foreseeable future. But we're finally starting to see a lot of these conferences start to move online as well. So a lot of the conferences I've just come out of a period of very hecticness, because a lot of the conferences I applied for in, like, you know, December, January, that were supposed to happen in, you know, May kind of time, then they pushed themselves back to like the last kind of quarter or last two quarters of the year. So suddenly had this glut of conferences come in September, October. I think my peak last week was 5 in 1 week. So,
do you do what I do with the conference talk, which is like basically leave it till the week before when you and start to panic and get it written all in panic mode, or are you more professional about it and able to get them done?
It depends. So I have kind of some talks that I've given a few times before, so they're easier because they're obviously one's already presented and the talk's ready to go. Normally, just needs to be updated slightly for. Yeah. Any changes that have happened to libraries or in the community. For new talks, I tend to start working on them really once they kind of get accepted, but more in a very abstract way. You know, I'll just start mulling it over and kind of thinking about it. But I won't start normally writing it until maybe like 2 weeks before. And then I have this horrible habit of like two nights before, the night before, going, I hate all my slides. And then like pulling an all-nighter and redoing every single slide. Which I'm not able to do as much now, because what I've started doing for the online talks is I actually use a teleprompter. So
okay.
for people who are not aware, it's, you know, like a piece of one-way glass, like a mirror fronted, which is has my a tablet being reflected on it with the essentially the script of what I want to say. And then mounted behind that is a camera. So I'm reading off this mirror, but looking directly into the camera, which I think makes a huge difference for talks, because I'm not like looking down at my laptop, or, you know, it's really difficult to give a talk and look directly into the camera, because then I need to look down at my speaker notes, or I need to look at other things. Whereas this way, I'm looking directly into the camera the whole time. But it does mean I then have to have the entire script written for what I want to say, which I've never done before. Normally I have my slides and I have a few bullet points in my speaker notes, and, you know, beyond that, I just kind of wing it. So now what I end up having to do is do that, record myself winging it essentially, and then go back and write the script based on what I've said. So there's a lot more prep required now for talks than there was whenever I was just traveling.
Fine. I've seen a few photos on Twitter. You all seem to have these kind of professional recording studios now with like sounded sides and green screens and, you know, all the gear.
Yeah, pretty much. That's the only, the apartment I'm in Miami at the moment, it's, you know, very hip and modern, and it's, you know, the unfinished concrete ceilings and very tall ceilings and all the rest, which means it echoes, which you'll probably hear in my microphone at the minute. I actually have two soundproofing panels either side of me trying to cut some of it down, and I'm using a lapel mic to try and cut some of it down. But even with that, it's still very, very echoey. So I've got some of that stuff that obviously you're trying to work in your lighting, and then you've got, so like I use a DSLR for a cam link for the actual recording. And yeah, there's a lot of new equipment you need to think about, which we didn't have to before. But in, you know, I kind of feel bad expensing all of this in the company, but they're not paying to fly me halfway around the world at the same time. So,
right. It's probably cheaper.
Yeah.
On the topic of Mongo, could you just quickly make the case relational versus non-relational? And, you know, there are some cases where Mongo with Django might make sense.
Yeah, how are we going to use it with Django? Because it does, you say it does, it's not the first thing that comes to mind, but, you know, regularly there'll be a message to the user group or the forum or the Django developers, you know, how do I use Django with Mongo?
Honestly, it is something that's come up quite, like, I've seen emails for it when I've been on the DSF and things as well. And it's something I'm pushing for internally at Mongo. Historically, we've probably had more of developer evangelists than advocates. The difference I see is with an advocate, you're, as well as being kind of the voice of the community, or sorry, the voice of the company in the community, you're also the voice of the community in the company. So I spend time advocating for, you know, increasing or providing some support to add support from MongoDB to Django. Obviously, the difficulty of it being is it's not something we can just fund. You know, we can't just give a bunch of money to the DSF to pay for it. You know, there's restrictions there on because of DSF's nonprofit status that they can't essentially do like guided work like that. You know, we can't pay and then our company can't pay the DSF and for a particular piece of work. You know, we could make a donation, but that donation has to be just to DSF as a whole. You can't then prescribe what they should use that donation for.
But also, they're not allowed to fund software development, right? So the fellows role, it's interesting that we're, as fellows, yeah. Maris and I, we're community managers, we're not there to write software.
Yeah. And even without that, the separation between the DSF board and the technical board is there for a reason. And it means that we can't influence the direction of Django's development anyway. And the DSF's role is not there to steer the technical direction of Django. It's more there to look after the actual foundation itself and protect the usage of the trademark and ensure that the fellows get paid and that we have funding and that whenever groups like Django Girls or et cetera apply for grants that we can meet those requirements, or sorry, we can meet those requests. You know, it's not there to steer the actual technical direction of Django. So it's something that, like, I declared whenever I was obviously joining DSF that I did work for MongoDB, I did work for a software company, but there's no conflict because I don't have any say in the technical direction anyway. So it's an interesting position to be in because I'm obviously a big fan of Django and it's a big part of my life and a big part of the community. But in the company I work for, you can't currently use in Django in any meaningful way. There's a couple of different packages that have tried to add Django support. The Django is probably the most popular one, which I think actually, unfortunately, doesn't work with Django 3, needs to be updated for that. I am hopeful with the changes coming down the line with Django Async that it's going to be easier for me to make the case going forward that we should be applying a lot of our own kind of time internally to help and support Django, rather than looking at something that we could fund in the community, looking at as something that we should be releasing ourselves and supporting ourselves. Like MongoDB has two different Python drivers and already ODM. So instead of an ORM,
it's like the ORM, but
yeah. Yeah, so an object document mapper rather than object relations mapper. So like we already have an ODM that's in Python. We have Motor, which is our async driver for Python, and we have PyMongo, which is probably the one that most people are more aware of. So we already have quite good Python support, but the way that they're looking at the moment is like, well, if Django wants support for Mongo, then they can use the existing ODM and integrate that. And it's, whereas what I'm saying is like, well, no, we should be trying to support that ourselves. You know, that's, if we want to have that first party support in Django, then that's something that we need to step up and provide. We can't just, you know, throw money at it or wait for the community to do it.
I mean, from a user's point of view, I guess what you want, right, is you want your Django models to just kind of, I've already got my Django models, I've already got my Django project. I want to just be able to save them to MongoDB. I kind of want a back end, but then there's going to be limitations in the mismatch between the relational model where you've got annotations and joins and I don't know what, and then the document model.
Yeah, it's obviously a different way of thinking about it as well between kind of the document model and the relation model. Honestly, the kind of the big ones people keep putting out is the advantage of document model is that it's like schemaless, you know, so you wouldn't need something like migrations. You would just make your changes to your models and that would be fine. It would just work. Honestly, it is an advantage and sometimes a disadvantage. Really, for me, where I think MongoDB shines is in things like its aggregation pipeline. So the aggregation pipeline allows you to apply basically data transformations in stages. You know, so you might have a match stage, which is essentially like a select. You know, so find me all documents that match this query. But you might have a project stage, which will allow you then to make modifications to each document. You know, so you're going, okay, well, I only want these four fields, or actually, I want this field, but I don't want the value of it. I want the length of it, or I want to sum these two fields together and add this as an attribute onto my document. And you can do incredible things with aggregation pipelines. So I'm using it at the minute. I did this talk at DjangoCon Europe where I spidered like 10 million domains, and then was trying to like just for the headers of what they returned, and then was interrogating that data set to try and find interesting things that were returned. And being able to use aggregation pipelines, I could do things like I had a dictionary of all the headers. I could convert that dictionary into an array where each item in the array was a dictionary in itself with a KV, where K being the dictionary key from the headers dictionary and V being the original value. So I could start querying on that, and I could do things like, you know, work out what the average number of headers were that were being returned per site, or what the largest header returned was, or I could run regexes against the keys or the values to look for. Okay, so let's pull out what the oldest PHP version being used is, or let's look for, lots of places had these like powered by or X powered by, you know, so let's try and group those together. And all of that I can do in a single query using like an aggregation pipeline.
So is that dynamic? Is like that's calculated in real time, rather? Because the process you're describing sounds very much like a Hadoop MapReduce process, but you'd run that batch offline, whereas Mongo's doing it on demand, so to speak.
It's doing it on demand. You can also create views out of it. So essentially, it looks like a regular collection that you can then query, but that's coming out of a pipeline, and that, again, that's live as well. So it's really the aggregation pipelines is the bit where I think MongoDB really adds value. So just swapping out like the Django ORM for a MongoDB ODM, you're not going to get the major advantage. You know, just being able to have your data models there and query them as per normal, you know, that's not where you're going to see any big difference. Okay, it's going to probably be a bit easier for you not to worry about migrations. And I personally find it easier to think of things as objects. You know, so I have a you know, object-oriented programming. I have my class and I have my different attributes on that class, etc. And then I don't need to worry about transforming that into a relational structure to put it in my database. I just send that to my database. You know, that kind of maps better for me. It honestly, it took a while for it to click, but then once it did, you know, that's, I don't need to worry about data structures anymore. It's just like, it's an object, and it's an object in my database, and it's an object in my Python code, and it's just an object, and I can just use it same everywhere. So those are key advantages, but you don't really get the full power until you also have support for the aggregation pipeline. And how we would get that into Django, or what the interface of that would look like, that's the bit where I think needs a lot of careful consideration.
So what web frameworks or what areas currently use MongoDB a lot? I mean, because naively, I would assume JavaScript. I worked with Meteor.js, which I think is still around, which we use Mongo. But what's the lay of the land in terms of who's using MongoDB in terms of frameworks and languages?
So Mean,
if you had to, you know, draw a big pie.
Mean is obviously still
my
the
sense
big
is
one.
It's JavaScript, but I don't really know if that's an accurate one.
No, that's pretty accurate. Like the Mean stack is still huge, you know. So
yeah, Mean stack, and then anything that's like unstructured, huge. You know, I don't know. I don't know if the NSA is using Mongo, but they're using non-relational to make the haystack.
Yeah, it kind of makes sense a lot in JavaScript because they're so used to just passing about these like JSON. And essentially, MongoDB actually isn't JSON, it's BSON. So it's slightly different, but for all intents and purposes, we can, it's like JSON with more types, essentially. So for JavaScript developers, it kind of makes sense to them. You know, it's just in JSON everywhere. You know, they just send a JSON to their database, it sends JSON back, and they don't need to worry again about like doing any kind of transformations on objects and stuff. So it is really popular there. I can't really talk an awful lot about individual clients with like clearing it with the departments first, but what we're also seeing a lot of use in at the moment is we purchased Realm about a year ago. So Realm is it's an on-device database designed for mobile.
It's like SQLite, but not relational.
Yeah, but it's, again, it's an object store, but it stores live objects. So you don't really need to worry about kind of reading or writing from the database. You just get your object, and then you can use that in your code, and it manages the read and writes for you in the background. What it also does is manages sync. So you can set it up so it'll automatically sync to our cloud service. And it'll do things like automatic conflict resolution for you as well. So if you have multiple devices that are all connected to or all using the same Realm database, and one of them goes offline for a while, whenever it comes back online, then it'll automatically sync the data and resolve any conflicts that have happened since it's been offline. So
that's pretty nice.
Yeah, there's been a lot of work in getting it kind of integrated with kind of our Atlas, which is our cloud server. And it's a team that I'm on, and so it's a lot of fun to work with, to be honest. We for Hacktoberfest, which is coming up, we're working with a group called WildAid, and we built an app for them, which essentially WildAid is like wildlife conservation. And one of the areas that they do is they do a lot of ship inspections. So they'll board ships to ensure that they are, you know, they're not breaching any fishing licenses or any of that kind of stuff, that they're not in any kind of breaches of wildlife regulations. So whenever they're on board the ships, they don't really have internet connections, as you can imagine. You know, they could be out in the middle of the ocean. So before, what they were doing was they had, you know, paper forms that they would fill out whenever they boarded the ship. And then these paper forms would come back to the main office, normally very wet and smudged and everything else. And they would try their best to collate the information into like a database. Now they have just a Android device that they take on the ship. They fill in the form. They can also pull down any of the information for the area before they go out. So if they are expecting to see particular vessels, or they know particular vessels in the area, they can get the most recent information about it and any previous boarding reports and have that on their local device. Do the boarding, take their photographs, make their notes, etc. And then as soon as they get a connection, then that's automatically synced up with the main database. So that's all open source. We actually built it in conjunction with them as part of MongoDB World, which happened a few months ago. It's now kind of, they're using it like in the wild, as it were. There's more development needs done on it. Obviously, there's additional features, as there always are. So that's how we're making it our Hacktoberfest kind of project and looking for contributors there. So
yeah, we'll have a link to that. That's that whole realm of online except occasionally off is so interesting when you think about it. Like, because my brother-in-law worked at a startup that was doing order delivery for restaurants where they have a device. They literally go in the cooler, which is just like a steel box.
Yeah.
And they, like, he had to, I think they're using Flask for that, but they had to jump through all these hoops to deal with, yeah, just quitting out, even if they have Wi-Fi, because they're going in this huge steel cage for orders. So just one example of many where, you know,
yeah,
that would solve a lot of problems to have a
better It's a pretty solution. Common one, that stock collation thing, because a lot of, as you said, it's like if they're going into freezers or they're going into big metal warehouses, it's like they're just basically walking into a giant Faraday cage. You know, so,
yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But I remember one company I used to work for, an ed tech company, we also were doing a demos. It was a video streaming company, you know, so they produced their own videos that would be streamed in classrooms and schools, and it was all Django based. And we had a big booth at a...
Really?
Yeah. Still is as well. It was...
What's it called?
It's Twig. TWIG. So Twig World, I think, is the twigworld.co.uk.com's URL. But they do these short instructional videos for schools, kind of like 3-minute long, you know, videos on science, biology, chemistry, physics, that kind of idea. So it's a video streaming, and quality of streaming, lack of buffering was a big thing for us to be able to show at this conference. But as anybody's been to any big conference knows, you can never rely on conference internet. So the way we got around, doing the kind of online offline there was, we literally had a little server sitting on our booth at the conference that was just serving up the media files. So anything large, you know, so like all the video files, image files, PDFs, all that kind of stuff. And then we had a DNS, local DNS that would resolve to that box for any requests. So all of our demo machines, they would be running the web application online, but all of the large media, which was served behind like a static.twigworld or videos.twigworld, whatever it was, would be coming from the local network. But also meant as well, we were then able to offer a, you know, an open access point that other people coming to the booth could join. And then if they wanted to watch it on their phones, they got the exact same experience. You know, they were still getting these videos essentially like offline at the conference.
Huh, that's awesome. Yeah. So, anyone who's had to go, I mean, I worked at an ed tech company and went to some demos, and it would have been nice to have had that. That's such a smart idea. I guess you do it enough times and you're like, we need a better solution here for.
Yeah. The year before, we had essentially rebuilt the entire stack on like local machines and just brought that all down with us. So, and this was kind of just containerization was really only just starting. So with some of the bits we're starting to move across, other bits weren't, and it was a bit of a nightmare, honestly, to try and get this deployed onto local machines and ensure that like all of the URLs were getting routed correctly and stuff. And we spent the entire time kind of being a little bit on edge. So next year we were like, okay, we don't want to bring our entire stack down. We're pretty confident that the conference internet can handle at least fetching the HTML from, you know, the actual application code. We just don't want to stream videos. And that was our solution. It was like, okay, well, let's take the videos offline and keep everything else just running on the regular servers. And it worked pretty well, to be honest.
So can I cut back to Mongo? If say I'm listening to the episode, I think I want to give Mongo a go. What's my best way of hosting it? Because is it a cloud service like Mongo's hosted for,
Alice,
or should I spin up my own? Because let me give you back. I haven't used Mongo for quite a few years, but when we did a few years ago, and no doubt it's all changed from then, we had trouble. It was difficult to maintain and difficult to scale, and it was hard work. So what would you advise? I don't know. A, it's no doubt changed from then. This was 6 years ago, 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. But what would you say if I'm going to give it a go and I want to give it a play? What should I spin up?
So the first thing I'd say is don't do apt-get install. Like, do not install it via like apt-get or any of the package managers. They are all so far behind. I think some of them are still running like 2.2 and we're now in 4.4. You know, it's ridiculous how far some of them are behind. And that's normally the issues that we come across is people are still running really, really old versions of MongoDB. You know, and yeah, MongoDB, like any technology, had some teething problems at the start, which are now all being sorted. You know, we still get people coming up, oh, but you don't have transactions. It's like, yeah, we do. It's fully ACID compliant. You know, yes, we didn't have transactions,
you know, five years ago.
Yeah. We have them now. Or that MongoDB is insecure. It's like, no, MongoDB, until you set up your like access controls, until you set up your username, etc., your admin user, you can only access it from localhost. You know, it binds localhost and you cannot access it from anywhere else in I. So you need to actually go in and configure it yourself to make it public. You know, it's the security, by the default security settings are a lot stricter than what they used to be. And these are all things that if you're installing older versions of MongoDB, of course you're still going to get the old issues that came with it. So my first advice would be, like, don't install it from apt-get. You know, go and actually get the release directly from us. The other thing is watch Mark's talk. So Mark Smith, Judy2K, most people know him as on Twitter. He's done a talk recently. I think it was at EuroPython, I'm not 100% sure, on misconceptions about MongoDB. So he runs through a lot of this kind of stuff about, you know, where you should install it from, misconceptions people can have. And yeah, it gives a good kind of, like, for people, even like ourselves, whenever we join MongoDB, you know, you might not be completely up to date with it, and you'll have these similar conceptions you have, Carlton, about like what MongoDB is or was, and that clears up a lot of them. So I'd probably watch that first just to kind of get some information on it. If I'm setting up for myself now, I just use Atlas. So Atlas is MongoDB's cloud kind of hosted managed service. It's got a free tier, like a kind of, you know, free forever tier. You can deploy it to AWS, Azure, and somewhere else, I think. You know, so you can try and keep your latency down by deploying it as close to where the rest of your infrastructure is as possible. But it's, you know, it's so simple to set up. It's like button clicks.
I mean, my number one advice for databases is get a managed database, right?
Yeah.
It's the best money you'll ever spend. It's like, don't spend your time and energy doing that unless that's your profession. Like, you know.
100%. You know, and so the free tier is 99% of the stuff that I do all uses it. The only thing that I've had to use any of the paid tiers for is the projects I was earlier with DjangoCon Europe. So
yeah, I was going to say, does 10 million data sets fit into free?
10 million doesn't quite, just sheerly because of the size, to be honest. So I had to upgrade the size in that one. I think it's costing like maybe like $9 a month or something like that. Okay. So,
wow, that's still, I'm trying to remember back to my Meteor Mongo days. I think their thing was called Atlas 2 or something similar, because when I worked, to your point about switching to a non-relational database and just different frameworks, when I worked on Meteor, I'd already done Django for a couple of years, and I did that for a year and a half and then back to Django. And it's, yeah, hosting databases was just boom, built in. They had all the auth stuff was built in. It's kind of amazing just seeing a different spectrum of the customization, mm-hmm. Where you could be. And at the time, like, I taught a class at a college with Meteor, and we got basically total beginners to build websites in a month, like really dynamic websites. So it's really, and I think by looking back, I think the biggest thing was it was just one click, like install Meteor, and it had Mongo in there, and everything just kind of worked. And then it was a hosted solution. And this was, 5 years ago. Like, I wish, when I think of Django and what trips people up, beginners, you know, databases and deployment is a big one. There isn't, there's Heroku, there's Python Anywhere, there's a bunch of things. But for a true beginner, it's still quite a bit more challenging than JavaScript in a Mongo solution.
Yeah. No, I agree.
So it's interesting just to play around in a different sandbox and see the choices they make and be like, wow, that has some advantages. I mean, maybe different things down the line, but starting out... yeah, it'd be amazing if Django had a hosted solution that just one clicked in. I mean, and you really don't, is the thing, right? Because you default to local settings, and you got to update static, and there's a whole bunch of things, and that has benefits, but there is a little cost for beginners.
Yeah, Django has gone a heck of a lot better, though. I remember like first starting out on it, and you would do your kind of pip install and your Django admin start project, and then you would try and, you know, run server, and like none of your CSS would load. You know, you go to admin page, and it's just like just raw HTML. You know, you'd have to go configure. First of all, it wouldn't serve any static files, so you'd have to have like Cherry Pie or something running to serve the static files for you. And there was no like collect static at that stage either. And yeah, it's come a long way and become a lot easier. So the work that's been done is phenomenal. But yeah. It's still, deploying Django is still difficult as well. You know, it's, as you said, there's no kind of one-click deployment. Heroku used to have like their Django Heroku package, but even that's being deprecated now.
Kenneth had set that up and that's deprecated. I mean, Heroku is still, so that's the one I teach in my books just because they have a free tier. And if I tell you exactly what to do, you can do it in 5-6 steps. Mm-hmm. But if you try to navigate their docs, I don't think there's a lot of older things out there and people get tripped up. I mean, one thing, and there's also environment variables, which is another thing which you need for Heroku and most platforms as a service, plus you should use anyways. That's another one that really, for beginners, though there are a number of packages that make that a little bit easier. And that was a big thing for me with the 3.1 updates. I included my beginner's book is showing how to use environment variables, which I was a little uneasy about, but it makes settings files. You know, if you're going to do any sort of actual deployment that isn't wildly insecure, you have to use environment variables.
100%. And it's actually a talk I gave recently at PyCon Australia, was like on how to manage
secrets. Yeah, the secrets one. We have a link to that, yeah.
It's so easy just to hard code a secret. Like even experienced developers do. You know, it's just a proof of concept, or it's just a really quick hack and you're not quite sure that you're going to keep this in here, or, you know, you don't want to go freeze adding it to your key management store or whatever else. So you just hard code it for a second and you're definitely going to take it out before you push your code up, you know. And it's, and then whatever happens, you forget about it, or you go away to make coffee, you come back, your muscle memory kicks in, you do a git push, and suddenly your AWS keys or whatever key is now up on GitHub and publicly available. You know, or even
I was gonna say GitHub now has, they'll notify you. They've like, generally I think they acquired a company that will sort of tell you, hey, there's a secret key hanging out in your repo. And I remember like early GitHub, you could just search for like secret keys and stuff. Mm-hmm. And now you can't do like a broad search. So they help you a little bit, but it doesn't solve the problem. If someone has access to your GitHub repo, you know, there's 100 engineers.
Yeah.
Also, right, for security, you don't want them floating around.
Yeah, 100%. You know, especially even if you then remember and delete it, well, it's still in your Git history. You know, you've got to assume as soon as that's pushed up, it's been compromised. Like,
that was another thing in my professionals book. I sort of walked through updating the secret key in the 3.0 version, but then, it's still in the source code. So there's a couple ways to do it to generate. I mean, because it's any 50 plus character string. And you can use, Python has a secrets module. There's at least one or two websites which will generate a Django secret key. Totally, I'm guilty of it. And actually for me, like I have repos of my stuff up there teaching where I have the secret key in and we swap it out. And GitHub regularly pings me being like, you've got secret keys, which is nice that they do, but a little annoying that I could unsubscribe. Yeah, everyone does it, to your point on the talk. And I like that was a great talk too.
Oh, it happens to everybody eventually. That's you also have to kind of then plan for it too. You need to know what is my disaster recovery for this. You know, it is going to happen at some stage. So you need to know how do I rotate keys? You know, how do we revoke keys? What's the process for that? You know, how do we then go about reissuing them? It's like any other kind of disaster recovery. You hope that doesn't happen, but you need to plan for it to happen.
No, but it will as well, because like you want to, I think that's an awesome point. Like, because you, like, even your database credentials, just because you kept them secret doesn't mean you don't want to change them every so often, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, just for
people leave the company or whatever else, you know, you know, you're going to have to rotate them eventually. It is actually something that's quite nice with some of the Realm stuff as well, is it also can have, like, manage your users for you. So you don't really have an admin user as such that can be exposed. And so register their own accounts, and then, well, it's one way you can access it. You can set it so users can be registered on accounts, and then you can set like on databases, or sorry, on collections, or even down to like field level, what the access rights are on that are. So you can go, okay, well, users can read all data that's in this collection, but they can only write or edit their own data. you know, you can set that at a database level. So you don't need to worry about that, that kind of business logic in your code. You know, so instead of like going, okay, I'm going to do a find and only give me back the documents that this person, that the author ID is equal to their user ID. You know, you can just go, okay, give me all documents and I'm logged in as this user. And it will automatically go, okay, well, this user only has access to these documents and just return those. You know, so it takes out that, that kind of like business logic. You don't need to worry about it. It's all done at the kind of service level, which is really nice.
You still don't want to display an edit UI for, you know, if I haven't got edit permissions, I don't want the edit UI presented, right? So
yeah.
You still kind of need to deal with that, but yeah.
Well, yeah, yeah. You still deal with that kind of side of it as well. But it just means that then you don't have any kind of administration, like admin credentials to expose, which means you can then move it into the client side as well. You don't even need a server to run your queries.
I was just checking. There still is, was it Django login as, which you can, third-party package where that's, I think it's more for users as opposed to like admins or devs, but that's incredibly useful if you're trying to debug. Mm-hmm. Someone says, I'm getting this issue. You can just log into your site literally as them and see it.
That's one. If you have, if you're a super user, you do like your username as, and then like your customer's username and then your password and it authenticates you as the customer. Yeah. I used to use that a lot.
Yeah. It's only got 230 stars. I think this is the one, but it's incredibly useful.
It's a similar similar package called Django Hijack as well, which does a kind of
that's the other one. Yeah.
Thing.
And they both keep, the one. Does Hijack keep like logs as well of like when people have logged in as other people?
I believe it
does. I know login as does or did. Because that was a big thing. So you wanted to make sure that people weren't abusing it, like log in as potential users. So it had like an access log of like who had logged in as like which user and when they did it.
Yeah, you need that sort of thing.
We'll put links to both in the notes and we should check that out. They're both, that functionality is incredibly useful.
Yeah. For debugging like customer issues, it was indispensable, to be honest.
Yeah, I know. Because otherwise you're just like, you know, trying to tell them how to take a screenshot video and yada, yada, yada. And it's just, they can't do it.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you, as we're coming up on time, I first saw you and came to know about you from your pip install talk. And it's like the left pad problem from 2016, which fantastic talk. I wonder if you could talk about that. And I think you're planning an update to it, right? Because it was a couple years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think I gave that first time at like PyCon UK. And it was just after there'd been that issue with NPM where, a maintainer had removed a package called LeftPad, which in itself was a very small package and just allowed you to pad a string, but was a dependency of so many other packages that it took down hundreds of thousands of CI processes around the world as they attempted to install this package that no longer existed. So the talk really kind of was looking at it, you know, how you can really secure your installation process and your dependencies and things like the obvious stuff of around like pinning dependencies, but then also how we'd run your own local G-shop, so your own local package index and a bunch of other stuff. And honestly, most of what I discussed in that talk is still relevant now. You know, not an awful lot has changed. Some of the we've kind of had since then, there was a move towards pipenv and different package managers have kind of came and went during that time. But the core of it, you know, pinning your packages, checking package hashes to ensure they've not been modified from the version thing you're installing, how to run like your own local repository, all of that is still the same now as it was back then. I'd love to expand upon it. I think there's an awful lot around the Python ecosystem that can be quite difficult for people coming into it to start off with. You know, for your very early users, they really don't need to know an awful lot. You know, people, okay, we need to know virtual environments. You need to know about PyEnv. You need to know, about environment variables, and you need to know a bunch of other stuff. And it's like, well, no, really, to start off with, you just need to have a Python executable and write some Python in a file and call the file. You know, that's your very basic hello world. Let's get people interested. They can immediately see, you know, I put this input in, I get this output out. You know, it's that instant gratification get them hooked on programming. But once you kind of move into the more, you know, kind of intermediate level, then where you're like, okay, well, I want to keep, I've got several projects I'm working on. I want to keep my dependencies separate. I might have a legacy project that's on a different version of Python than what I'm currently using for my own more recent projects. Or, you know, I want to run Jupyter Labs, but I don't want to have a virtual environment for that. It's all things then you're going, okay, well, now we're going to need like virtual environments. That's fine. That's Python 3. We've got those already, but then you're looking at PyEnv, so you've got like multiple Python versions. Then you probably want to have like a virtual environment wrapper to make it a little bit easier to work with. Then you're looking at pipx, so you can run like Jupyter Labs without having to install it. And it's like, okay, well, now we've got all this stuff. How do we?
Then someone tells you about poetry, and then yeah, you're just like,
what's there's a bunch of new stuff in there. I have an like a Python, local Python development environment that I'm pretty happy with. It's taken me a couple of years to get there, but I've now got like everything set up that I kind of like. And because I do a lot of work with obviously different Python versions and different packages and things, you know, it allows, I can, if needs be, I can spin up a version of 2.7, you know.
But isn't that the problem right there, is that everyone has come to their own local thing that works. So when a newbie says, how do I just duplicate that?
Yeah.
A, there's many different ways to do it, and
100%.
And B, it's, you're talking about path variables, and it's non-trivial.
Yeah, so like any of these things, then I want to make sure my information's out there as well. Let's give people all the choice. No, it's very, very much true. Like everybody does have their own way of doing it, and like mine won't work for everybody. I hope it works for some people. It's honestly pretty simplified. I went down the road of like having poetry and having multiple different kind of editors and plugins and everything else. And now I have my virtual environments. So I have PyEnv and I have pipx, and that covers like 99% of my cases. You know, even the PyEnv is probably a little bit of overkill, to be honest. I think the only time recently I've had to install an older version of Python was actually to do a node installation where one of the packages was assuming you had Python 2 installed instead of Python 3. It was still using the old print statement. Which was interesting that I needed to have a particular version of Python installed in order to do an npm install. Because obviously web programming is not confusing enough for beginners.
Well, I was setting up a Windows machine recently and had to install Node.js, and I went to the website and it went, oh, just use the LTS. And I went, okay, I'll download the LTS, and I'm halfway through installing it. It's like, you need Python 2. I'm like, what? Yeah. Don't do this to me.
It really was the easiest way. It was like, okay, I can try and take these dependencies out, or I can, you know, if people were posting like fixes in that you could go and modify the module yourself in order to get it to work with 3, because it really was a very small change. You know, they were just calling the print statement in the Python 2 way instead of like calling the print function in Python 3. But it was like, well, I have PyEnv here. You know, I can just install 2.7. You know, make that the Python interpreter for this particular shell session, do my installation, and then, you know, not have to use it again.
Job's done.
I think that, well, there's online hosted Python things you can use. Like if you're teaching, you can use Replit, you can use Glitch. And I believe that VS Code is working towards this, if they don't, or having this where, you know, in 5 years, people look at us and go, well, you just log in and it's sort of a virtualized, it's like Docker in the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't even have to deal with this nonsense. I think, I'm not exactly sure where VS Code is at with this, but in terms of beginners, like, I think they're pretty close in terms of having it all, you know, like your own Docker spin up. So you can just use VS Code, and then everything is in the cloud. You don't have to worry about versions. That's sort of like game, set, match that solves a lot of these problems. I mean, it doesn't solve the fundamental ones in Python per se, but if it's hosted, you know, sort of like Docker for newbies. And I think, I'm pretty sure VS Code is working on that if they don't already have
it's super. Like GitHub's got this code spaces thing, which is on in
beta. Yeah, GitHub too.
I managed to get, but that's all part of the same deal, right?
And mm-hmm. it's, well, yeah, I guess, yeah. Nah.
But it,
yeah,
but it's super. It really is. It like it fires up, you know, a containerized environment. And you just open up VS Code and you do this remote thing, and it opens your VS Code, and it's just working. And yeah, you know, if you've got decent internet, it's, you know, it's indistinguishable from, you know, local development.
There's probably a way to have it work offline too if it flips out for you. From a business perspective, when you're containerizing things, there's much more of a cost to hosting than, you know, JavaScript or static files. So it's the type of thing that as a startup scales with virtualized things, you know, their costs are going to keep going up. It's a little bit easier for Microsoft to eat the cost of that long term. I think Glitch has even explicitly said I think it's still basically all free. They're going to grow it out and then do something with it. But anyways, there's some additional costs in the back end, but yeah, those things come down.
It's a smart move for them, because if you've got your containerized development environment, you've built your app, etc., and then, you know, it's okay, well, click this button to deploy to Azure.
Kind of a no-brainer. Exactly that. I mean, you can see all the pieces lining up. Well, so we're at 50 odd minutes. Is there anything you want to mention that we haven't? Anything else you want to plug personally or professionally?
All I would say is obviously the combination of MongoDB and Django is something that I'm very passionate about myself. I would love to hear if other people would like to see that as well. The more people I have kind of asking for it, and the better business case I can bring to my employers, that's obviously would be helpful. So if you would love to use MongoDB with Django, you know, or if you're already using MongoDB for something else alongside Django and you'd like to see an integration between the two, or you have a particular use case that you think would be compelling, then please do reach out. You know, you can either contact me via the DSF by email, or you can contact me on Twitter. My DMs are open. I would love to hear what people's kind of, what their wants are, what their use cases are, you know, anything I can help to build this case to bring MongoDB to Django would be really useful.
Well, and that's something I think we, the DSF board, if when we do the survey, hopefully next year, we could have some sort of questions around what people want. I guess in a way separate from Django developers, I know there's that's the main place where things are happening, but more of a generic, area to ask these kind of questions. I don't know. Does that make sense, Carlton, or is that crossing wires?
No, it does. It does make sense. It's the sort of, whenever anyone mentions new features, I get this massive sort of ice thing down the back of my neck. So I'm like, how on earth is this ever going to happen? Over time, we seem to keep rolling out new features.
Yeah, I wouldn't see it as something that would be actually in Django itself. You know, I would still see it as something that would be a package that you installed, like channels. We have the ability to do that now that the kind of database engines and stuff are easier to swap out. So it's not even something that a company could try and do, because that then the final decision about what would make it into Django is up to technical board, you know. So
absolutely,
there would need to be a very compelling reason for them to want to add it into the core, and I don't think that's going to be there, not for a very long time, but I would love to see it supported as a package that could be installed alongside Django.
But all features begin as third-party packages, you know?
Yeah.
Unless there's an absolute reason why it can't, it must. Yeah, South. Migrations was a third-party package. Right?
You know. I still have my t-shirt with the from the Django version release with when South got merged in. With all the birds flying away. It's a nice shirt. I like that shirt.
Yeah, good. I think for me, just on the Mongo point, I think if the querying is obviously different from the ORM's querying, but if we could somehow take the model classes and then leap that map to a document model somehow, then you would query the document model. But if you didn't have to duplicate, that's the trouble when you switch, the same with, you can put your models into Elasticsearch. You have to create an Elasticsearch document, which then, and it's kind of really similar. It's like, could I somehow automate this, this from my Django model to the Mongo document model so that I didn't have to type that out twice? That would be amazing. And didn't have to update it each time, you know. It's typing it once is fine, but, I've made an edit here. Now I need to make a matching edit over there. That's a pain.
Yeah, I kind of see it as working very similar to like the queue object, you know. So you've got your ORM, or in this case, it'd be like your ODM, and that's going to be how you interact your data like 99% of the time.
Yeah.
But then if you want to do something, you know, more bespoke or more complex, then there'll be like an MQ object, you know, which you can then use to create your aggregation pipeline or, you know, run any of the very specific kind of MongoDB type queries. You know, it's you want it as far as possible to be something that you can just swap into a project. And if you're not doing anything, you know, weird or wonderful, then it just works as the regular Django RM would. But if you want to use some of the features of MongoDB, then you're then dropping into a different kind of interface to that. And you're very aware that, you know, this is now MongoDB specific. You know, I will not be able to move this project easily from MongoDB back to Postgres or to SQLite or to whatever else, you know. For some reason, if like you, if you're writing raw SQL queries and you may be using some of the features of Postgres that's not supported by SQLite, you know, so you know you can't just easily use that in development and then Postgres in production. But it has to be that, for me anyway, there has to be that kind of separation, you know, so that people are very aware of when they're doing something that is specific to that particular database.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Cool. Super.
Agreed.
I'm excited.
Well, Aaron, we'll link to ways to contact you in the notes, but you're very accessible on Twitter and other platforms. Thank you for coming on and sharing.
Thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
And everyone, we are at ChatDjango on Twitter, djangochat.com, and we'll see you the next, how would you say it, Carlton? The next fortnight?
We'll see you in a fortnight. Yeah.
A fortnight.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll see you in a fortnight. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, folks.